You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
This podcast is brought to you in association with BHA Medical. BHA Medical source, supply, implement and innovate medical technology solutions across the globe. BHA provide market-leading services in COVID-19 testing kits, medical products, smart technology and consultancy. The most recent product is the VitalStream. The VitalStream is the world's most innovative, wireless, non-invasive patient monitor, using a simple disposable finger cuff to measure continuous beat-by-beat blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory rate, and other physiological parameters. This unique technology enables safe, secure, and accurate patient monitoring from virtually anywhere, including remote patient monitoring from a secure cloud portal. This solution provides real-time data, enabling healthcare staff to provide early intervention and rapid response to patients' changing healthcare conditions. So using a low-cost disposable finger cuff, the VitalStream patient pulse disposition analysis algorithm processes the arterial pulse waveform to derive the heart rate, the non-invasive blood pressure, the respiratory rate, and other parameters. So to see more on the VitalStream and BHA's unique products, please head to the show notes. Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself and Walker. In this session, we're looking at head injuries with Mark Wilson. So what I wanted to do is look at some of the fundamental issues of head injuries with consultant neurosurgeon Mark Wilson as we dig into the details of brain injury, primary and secondary injury, and the importance of venous drainage, and also look at the optimization of the pre-hospital management of head injuries. So welcome to the podcast, Mark.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
It's good to have you with us. So, Mark, as we sort of dig into some of the questions, I just wondered if you could just give us a potted history of your background.
Okay, so I've been involved with neurotrauma now for quite a long while, both from a pre-hospital care perspective, working with London's Airambulance and Kent Surrey Sussex Airambulance, and as a neurosurgeon, always with a specialist interest in a combination of intracranial pressure from an academic-y point of view and trauma. They go hand in hand, but trauma is extremely common, and it has a very big impact, not just on that person, but on their family, and more importantly, also on society as a whole. So actually, I think it's a big deal. So I kind of focus on brain injury with a trauma bent and the hyperacute management of that.
So as we sort of dig into that, Mark, could you maybe just speak to just maybe some of the anecdotal experience you see from the sociological perspective? And I guess that's a fancy way of saying, what do you see in practice from a head injury perspective, and how could we sort of mitigate that? I'm kind of notioning towards the fact that me and you have both done shifts together, both treated cyclists without helmets, both been to road traffic collisions where people haven't worn lap belts. Could you maybe just speak to some of your anecdotal experience of where you see the prevalence lying?
So, I think it's really important to distinguish two things here. One's mechanisms of injury, and one, the other's causes of injury. So, mechanisms of injury, we always talk about, you know, falls from height, RTCs, and sort of assaults as being the big ones. But they're not actually the causes of brain injury. The causes are usually alcohol, mental health, assaults and things like that, or, you know, violence. Poverty is a big cause of TBI. Addressing these is not really just addressing the mechanisms, it's addressing what's underlying why these patients are ending up in the situations that they're ending up in. So I think it's a much bigger piece than just the sort of the physiological bit you might imagine it to be to start with. I think from a sociological point of view, as sad as it is, and I see this a lot working in London, but actually doesn't matter where you work, you see a lot of patients that come in who maybe their first head injury, and they're particularly vulnerable in the first few months after that head injury. So they'll often be a little bit more irritable, aggressive, not their usual self, difficulty sleeping, difficulty concentrating, but it's the altered sort of irritability that is the main problem. And they're often unaware of it, or they don't have insight into it. And because most of these patients with a brain injury don't actually get operations, they don't have a scar on the side of their head, and society doesn't really give them the leeway that otherwise it might do. So you don't recognize that he or she's had a head injury. And then when they're a bit more aggressive a month later on the streets or wherever it might be, or at home, then that leads into much worse things. So it's common for families to fall apart after head injury. It's common for them, obviously, to lose their jobs. And I've seen people really spiral out. And the sad thing is that actually it's usually only a temporary period that things are as bad as they are at the start. But when people get into that situation, often they turn to alcohol, more alcohol, have another head injury, and you see the spiral occurring. And actually, if you look after people really well during that period, that really early phase, things can be just fine. But unfortunately, it goes on to have a large societal effect. And you know, I don't want to put a negative picture of brain injury because it's not all negative at all. Actually, it's really positive if you manage it well. But there is no question that the homeless population have a higher incidence of head injury. Prison population have a higher incidence. We just need to make sure that we're looking after these people because they are really vulnerable in that period. It's different to breaking a leg or, you know, breaking an arm. You're still the same person. This temporarily affects who you are, and that's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this succinct characterological change that if and especially if the support mechanisms aren't necessarily there, that there can be a real shift in levels of compassion, levels of support from sort of the external family. Just breaking down the pathology maybe into sort of TBI, traumatic brain injury and non-traumatic pathology, could you maybe speak to some of the fundamental differences in symptoms outside of just the external trauma?
Traumatic brain injury, you can broadly, in the UK at least, divide them into extra-axial hematomas, which are not brain injuries, they're extradurals and subdurals. If you leave them there, they cause brain injury. And then brain injury itself, so parenchymal injury, such as contusions, hematoma, diffuse axonal injury. And just going through the trauma side of it, first of all, there's kind of two types of blunt trauma injury. The kind of your head is sitting still and you get hit by something like a hammer, which causes a fracture, then causes an extradural. And then all the others that we tend to see are where your head is moving and then suddenly stops. And they call shearing injuries, so subdurals, DAI, contusions even. So that's traumatic brain injury in the UK. And obviously in the US, you have a high prevalence of penetrating trauma, high velocity gunshot wounds. And in other parts of the world, South Africa, you get low velocity penetration wounds. But we don't tend to see that many of those here. That's sort of traumatic brain injury in one category. And then the non-traumatic brain injury is a whole plethora of stuff, you know, largely vascular, largely stroke-related, and they are the sequelae of those very depend on where the pathology is and how extensive it is. And then there's things like hypoxic brain injury, secondary to, you know, cardiac arrest, and all those other things that can occur as well. I think one of the things that we're seeing more and more is in the elderly population, which is has increased over the last 15 years or so in terms of what we see in clinically now, is whether they've had a head injury and what caused their fall. Is that contusion actually a bleed in some way that they've then collapsed and hit their head, or vice versa? So I think we still struggle to a degree knowing etiology in a population where it hasn't been witnessed clearly at the start. But most of the time now we know what we're dealing with, and the management of very much depends on a whole host of factors, not just the pathology that's inside the head, but the actual patient as well, and what's right for them in many different ways, whether it be, you know, comorbidities or anticoagulation, whether it be what their wishes might be or what their family say their wishes might be. So there's a whole load of things. So I think one of the reasons I enjoy TBI is it is very different. There are so many different parts to the cookery mix that you have to take into account.
So Mark, me and you've both worked together on London's Air Ambulance and in a number of roles, but in your mind, and I guess I'd really be interested to know your take on this, which is kind of, does the pre-hospital doctor paramedic team positively affect outcome in patients with severe head injuries to your mind?
So I'm always very aware in all these situations of labeling the people doing the stuff. And this, you can, you know, the Twitter sphere is rife with this of, you know, who should be intubating in ED was the old one, you know, should be anaesthetist, should be ED. And it goes on and on. The actual names of the people I really don't give two hoots about. I think so long as the the team is competent, that's the most important, competent and highly governed. So if you look at services in sort of Ambulance Victoria and places where it's purely paramedic based, they do a very good job of pre-hospital anaesthesia and head injury, and they get some excellent jobs. It's highly governed. Equally, I could mention other services in the world where the paramedics aren't trained so well, and you could argue they don't get such good outcomes from their management. But it's not a paramedic or doctor thing. It's just about the right people. I could certainly count for places where doctors are on scene and don't know what they're doing. So actually, it's not the name, it's whether the people are competent. So the systems that we're used to in the UK, where there is often a doctor and paramedic team that are both well-trained, well-versed with an SOP that will give pretty consistent care in terms of management of TBI, I think that is a really good model. And I think that if you're auditing your results and demonstrating that you're not having large numbers of complications, or you're not having, whether that be failed intubations, or whether it be regular hypotension because you're giving too much fentanyl, whatever it might be, as long as you're auditing everything and making sure that everything's within the boundaries of what it should be, then I think your system is good. But it's more than just doctor paramedic. It's actually the system that's bringing the benefit.
So, Mark, in your mind, how accurate are we as pre-hospital clinicians in diagnosing head injuries?
The first point there is what you said there about head injuries, because it's quite easy to diagnose head injury. Someone's got a bump on the head. It's brain injury that's difficult to diagnose in the pre-hospital arena. And I think most people probably don't try and diagnose the type of brain injury. They just go low GCS or irritable, agitated on scene, likely to be some kind of brain injury. Let's do an RSI and take and get a scan. And you can talk about the reasons for scanning and all the reasons for RSI, and that's a sort of separate thing. But actually diagnosing what kind of brain injury they've got, have they got a subdural, have they got contusions? I don't think we do. I think most people don't even think about that. They just go low GCS, needs to go to hospital, have a scan. I always try to, more of a game than anything else, work out what's going on inside someone's head. So, it's not a particularly clever thing. You're just looking at the patient. So you're going, you're older, you're on warfarin, you're putting all these things together and saying, I think you're going to end up with a combination of your, who you are, the fact you're older and warfarin, and the combination of how you're behaving, you might well say, I think they've got an expanding extraaxial hematoma, or they're likely to be contused in the frontal lobes because of the way they're agitated on scene, or whatever it might be. So you can try, I think everyone should try and diagnose what's going on inside someone's head, but how accurate we are, I think it's largely experience-based, and it's still quite difficult. You still turn up to patients who are agitated, are they agitated because they're, drunk, or they've had a bit of hypoxia for a little while. Are they just irritable because that's what they're normally like, or they've just had a fight. So there's so many different ways, things that confound us. I think it is very difficult to diagnose just clinically in that pre-hospital arena, but it's always worth trying.
So looking at the literature, or indeed actually at your anecdotal experience, Mark, how do you see sort of the triaging of patients to the Crick Neurological Centre playing out? So you work in an MCC, you work at St Mary's. Do you see a lot of these patients ending up in the right centres from a primary transfer perspective?
Yeah, so I think the trauma triage trees and things are good in how they're working. I think they're working well. I think that you always have to balance the distance to transfer or distance to move versus sort of the sensitivity of that. Largely, we get it right. I think it's much certainly better than it was 20 years ago. Those are all good things. Even the whole MTC and network structures are so much better. I do think we are got a better handle. There's obviously much more we can do as well. But I do think we're also at a point, mind you, I have said this for a little while now, but we are at a point where things will change in terms of our ability to diagnose in the pre-hospital environment. The world of biomarkers is becoming more real. If you look at Scandinavia, they'll do an S100 level in the, not in the pre-hospital arena, but in hospital for people with GCS 13, 14, rather than doing a scan. If you think of the number of patients we see on a Friday night who are drunk, who get a scan, who actually could have just had a S100 level and then scanned it positive, that would save quite a lot of radiation. Now, as that moves not necessarily S100, but as other biomarkers move into the pre-hospital arena, that might give us a more, you know, a better tool to say, well, actually, we should be driving the extra 20 minutes to a neurosurgical center because this person is positive and therefore they might well have a brain injury. So I think we're at a time where this might change, and whether it be biomarkers, imaging is occurring, you know, whether it be the infrascanner type devices or other NIRS type devices that, or even CT in some places. But that will help as well. I think it's probably not quite there. You know, it's been another 10 years before anything like that becomes universal. But the biomarker stuff is probably within that time frame a real thing.
So I suppose I'm throwing all the difficult questions at you, but I suppose another question, Mark, would be around, you know, me and self have delivered pre-hospital anesthesia to patients with head injuries with direct transfer to a neurological center. From your perspective, are these patients doing better than outcomes where these traumatic brain injuries are being intubated in hospital or indeed in ED?
Oh, well, I think you can see, if you go back even, probably, I don't know how old the paper is now, Patel's paper from, I think, 15 years ago, which showed that better outcomes from being in a neurosciences center. That still plays out, I'm quite sure. It's not just about looking after their brain better, it's about looking after everything else. So these patients will commonly vomit and aspirate. So for minimizing that risk early on is an important thing to do. I don't know how much the other tweaks we do in terms of, you know, measuring, you know, ICP and titrating CPP for different types of brain injuries. I don't know how much of a difference that makes, other than providing good care. You know, if you've got someone there who's actually providing good nursing care on the bed, such so they're paying attention to all those things, they're paying attention to everything else, or they're paying attention to the risk of them getting a chest infection or VAP and all the other things that might be occurring, or getting on top of that quickly, all those good bits of medical care are probably as, if not more important, necessary than tweaking little, you know, numbers, which often have got some inaccuracy in them anyway, tweaking them specifically for that patient, especially if you don't know what ideal numbers are for different types of brain injury. So I think doing the basics well is really key in all of this.
Listen, that's absolutely key. And I think that's a common theme across domains of practice, really. Absolutely, especially with the traumatic patient. So Mark, just shifting pace slightly and just looking at the front end of the call, could you maybe speak to the importance of sort of good emergency call taker advice before anyone arrives to the patient from suffering from a TBI? And indeed, even good advice, the advice from a HEMS paramedic in the control room.
Yeah, so I this is, again, another thing that's really exciting at the moment. The ability to work through other people's hands is something I think we've kind of done a little bit of, you know, in terms of telephone CPR and things like that, but it's probably not been used to its full advantage. It's largely because we haven't been able to see what's going on scene. And obviously I have a vested interest in this. The good SAM system we set up a little while ago is used by many ambulance services now and all 111 services. And it's not just about triage of patients, looking at a patient going, oh, he looks sick. They could do with a HEMS response because, you know, they're gray and ashen and all those things. But actually you can manage a patient through someone else's hands. And it's usually basic stuff. It's usually, you know, just keeping an airway open or stopping bleeding. You know, apply proper. I really need you to apply pressure there. That's not hard enough. Apply pressure. Or, as Freddie Lippert and others share, the quality of CPR, working through other people's hands is something we can do. And this is game-changing. I really passionately believe that, because you're never going to get ambulance call time or, you know, on-scene times faster unless you have unlimited ambulances. It's never going to get faster, really, than 8 minutes, or in London, and certainly in rural areas, it's going to always be longer. But if you can work through other people's hands, then you're instantly on scene. And so I think that's a very exciting area of pre-hospital care. There's certainly a skill set to diagnosing through audio, as we know, that's a massive skill set that's been used for years, but through video as well, and then managing, whether it be a TBI patient, whether it be a mental health patient, someone who, you know, bleeding from whatever it might be. All those things are a very defined skill set. And then I think, you know, there's ambulance services, certainly LAS is doing tons of this, as well as many others are around the world, and developing these skill sets. And there's a lot of shared learning to gain from that. So in particular for brain injury, I have a big interest in impact brain apnea, a phenomenon that most of us have never seen because we're not there. Well, actually, this is a time now where you can be there. We're seeing pathology in the first minute of it happening through the video system. So you could actually understand pathology a bit more and intervene in that period so that, you know, but when we do turn up with a truck, actually the patient's not quite as sick as they would otherwise have been, and make it all worthwhile for what you're going to do next. So, yeah, it's a really, really exciting area of medicine.
Isn't that a really fascinating point, actually, Mark? Because you've added functionality onto the Good Sam app, which allows the enablement of a camera phone. And actually, and you're right, because it's such an immediate pathology upon 999 or 911 call. But actually, the functionality that you've built into the Good Sam app actually probably even allows you to see this really rare impact brain apnea through the screen, which is also fascinating because you're quite right. That 4 or 5 minutes might be actually all it is before, and then someone, you know, the hospital services arrive on scene, and it's not present anymore.
Yeah. So just something. It's not within the app. It's actually a separate sort of thing. All it is the call handler rather sends a text to anyone's mobile phone. They don't need an app. They send a text. They click the link and then opens up their cameras. You get the location. You can see what's going on scene. You can see the patient, and you can measure pulse and respiratory rate through and various other things. And that can be forwarded on to get senior advice or bring other people in as well. So there's lots of sort of tweaks to it that makes it different to Teams or Zoom or anything like that. But it's the speed of it, the speed of you being able to be there within 5 to 10 seconds and see that pathology and make much earlier decisions. Rather than waiting for a HEM service, rather than waiting for a crew report, you can start right, or you can get going because actually you know, or not go. And that's another important thing, you know, saving resource for when it's really necessary. Whilst there is lots to do in terms of research around drugs in TBI and using, you know, NMDA antagonists or whatever it might be, none of them have really worked. TXA has worked. We can talk about slightly separately. TXA is you stops bleeding. And I know that some people argue it doesn't, but you know, it has been shown to be a benefit in TBI, but most drugs have not shown to be a benefit. So, but rather than focusing on that, I think logistics is really important. Getting the right person to the right place quickly is more important than necessarily any kind of medication that's out there at the moment.
So Mark, just changing tack slightly and just looking at some of the physiological markers, I learned this from you a long time ago and actually have seen it in practice. Could you maybe speak to the sort of deceptive nature of pupils and maybe some of the outliers you've seen in patients which have made a good recovery from maybe even indeed fixed and dilated pupils?
Yeah, so I think there's a certain level of complacency that occurs across the board. So I never hear people talk about fixed pupils. They always talk about fixed and dilated pupils. And I go, oh, well, they're dilated. What size are they? Oh, they're about midpoint. Oh, but why did you put the word dilated in there then? Because it's a bit like everyone's either GCS 3, 7, or 14, 15. There's no, you never see anyone 5 or anything. And people just don't really do it. So I think there's a level of complacency in this. And it's really quite dangerous. And the pupils is just one example. There's lots of reasons why pupils might not react, whether it be orbital trauma, medic drugs that they've taken or medication they're on, maybe just had a seizure. They may have a brainstem contusion or something, which it sounds bad, but actually, you know, we've seen people do quite well with that. So there's lots of reasons why. So you've got to be slightly cautious about interpreting them. Don't get me wrong, if someone's got fixed dilated pupils and they've been dilated for like 3 or 4 hours, the prognosis is pretty bad. You can't argue with that. But we did a meta-analysis quite a long while ago now of papers which had looked at fixed dilated pupils, which had concluded that it was a terrible thing. But when you actually look at the underlying pathology, if it's extradurals and the dilation is just due to shift, then actually removing that can do quite well. Over half of the people with fixed dilated pupils in that group, it was smallish numbers, actually had a good recovery. And Subdurals, they had a much worse recovery. Only about 7% of people did well with that, because subdurals are more associated with actual parenchymal injury. So you've got to look at the type of brain injury and as well as the neurology around it. And I'd be really cautious of calling it on extraaxial hematomas in young people, because they can do remarkably well. And let's say the extraaxial hematoma is an extraaxial hematoma. It's not a brain injury. Most people, even neurosurgeons, don't really get that. So you really think cautiously about that.
So just speaking to sort of markers, really, are there any other markers outside of, because one of the sort of revelations I had quite early on was that respiratory rate is really quite a sensitive marker, and you know, an elevated respiratory rate is a real cause for concern, either acute medical or trauma pathology. Could you speak to any other sort of symptoms or indeed markers that are helpful and or sensitive within assessment of TBI or indeed of pathology in the head?
So it's probably the opposite, actually, is that I wouldn't rely on markers. People always look for this Cushing's response of hypertension and bradycardia. That's a terminal thing. Once you got to that point, there's not much you can do. We see people who are hypotensive, code red level, which all they've had is an isolated head injury or brain injury. If you look at code red numbers, about 15% of them are actually just isolated TBI, which you shouldn't be able to be hypotensive from according to ATLS, because you can't bleed enough inside your head. But they are hypotensive because they've got an autonomic response. And respiratory wise, yeah, again, there's lots of reasons why someone's respiratory rate might be off, and you know, especially with TBI. But that could be a combination. It could be, you know, loss of airway. It could be just recovering from impact brain apnea. Lots of things can cause that. So I would be slightly cautious of inferring TBI from those vital signs, because it can reflect a lot of different things, not just the brain injury that's going on. I think the other thing to be very aware of, as we were talking about fixated people earlier on, is the term catastrophic brain injury, which people often use. And the reason why there's the guidelines that are out there now is because, one, it's because it's kind of ethically wrong to pull the tube and resus in an area that's busy and the family haven't got there yet and all those things. So going to ITU is a good thing from a family perspective, but also because we get it wrong. We do get it wrong. You think someone's got devastating neurology or devastating scan, but often it's not quite as bad as you might originally think. So having a period of a few hours at least to find out a bit more about the patient, a bit more about what their wishes might be, and look at their neurology when they're not just being intubated. So look at their neurology properly, putting that, all those things together, gives you a bit more time, gives the family time to come in. And not only is it sort of better all round, it also means that they've got an opportunity, if the family wish, to sort of organ donate and things like that, which might be a comfort to them, but actually also very good for the people who get the organs. So actually, being a bit more cautious about this term devastating brain injury, I think is an important thing.
So we've got a lot more patients, you know, since post CREST 3 trial that are being given TXA for head injuries within that first 3-hour window. Is that your anecdotal experience, Mark, that you're seeing the TXA on board and indeed being given prior to arrival?
So TXA is given now, and that's, you know, pretty much everyone's protocol, and that's not, you know, a good thing. But it's if you just look at the paper, people argue either way. It's probably not doing any harm. That's pretty clear. But in terms of how bigger effect it's having, I think there's a different, there's, you know, different camps. Certainly other studies have failed to show the benefit. But to be fair, you know, no other drug so far has ever shown benefit in TBI. It's a move in the right direction. And certainly, if you think about the patients that we're commonly seeing now, the older folk who are on aspirin, clopidogrel, or alcoholic or similar, it would make sense that TXA would be something that would help minimize the ongoing contusion involvement or bleeding. So it kind of all makes sense, and it's quite good. But whether the effect is as big as you might think, I don't know.
So, Mark, as we sort of start to come into land, could you maybe speak to a seminal case that sort of really emphasized good post-op care and of head injuries and indeed of the concomitant recovery of that head injury that you've seen in practice?
Yeah, I've got many, many cases that I've seen do well because of a correct chain of events that have occurred. I've also seen cases that have done incredibly badly from an incorrect chain of events. And if anyone's heard me talk before, I will always talk about if you're not dead on scene, you shouldn't die. An oversimplification. What I mean by that is if your motor score in your GCS is reasonable, M4-5, your brain injury is not that bad. And we as clinicians and scientists should be there to minimize the ongoing secondary brain injury development. So, we should be there to whether minimize hypoxia or hypotension, give the TXA, minimize the evolvement of that contusion. And when that's done well, I've certainly got people, medics who have had head injuries, I mean, in RTCs, who have been managed well in the pre-hospital arena, then come into hospital and been managed well in the ED from a point of view of, rather than just say, putting a bolt in and then saying to us, you actually go, I think this is going to evolve over the next couple of hours. Let's go and get another scan anyway. Just do another scan. Not worth the hassle, just do it. Finding it's evolving, gone to theatre. All those kinds of things make a difference. And then also on the other side of it is the patients that we carry on with. I've seen people who have been, I don't want to give examples in the sense that some of the stuff will be identifiable as to where they got run over and things. There's certainly patients that I feel they're not going to do very well with that horrific on MR, brainstem, both sides, contusion. And then amazingly, they do okay. And what is terrifying really is they come back to clinic and there's a lady who I didn't think would do very well at all. She's older again. So you think, well, actually older folk tend not to do so well with TBI. And she's had a brainstem contusion, went all the way up into a cerebral peduncle. And she's loving listening to opera. She goes out to the theatre. She's in a wheelchair, but she goes out to theatres and cognitive, she plays chess internationally online. I mean, cognitively completely with it. And you think you've got to be really careful because what you think might be terrible because it's brainstem, it might not be quite as bad as you think. Again, had very good care and didn't give up. But you can't do that for absolutely everyone. There has to be a ceiling of care where you go, well, actually, we do think this person had their chance to recover and they're really not recovering. And therefore, you also don't persist with things that are unfair on that patient and unfair on that family. And it's finding that balance. And it is different for different families. It's different for different people. It's working with them for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it speaks to the nuances of care and that each situation and circumstance is different, as you were saying. Mark, as we come into land, is there any take-home messages for sort of the cadre of paramedics, nurses, doctors that practice pre-hospital care that you'd maybe like to mention as we finish off?
Well, only that the pre-hospital arena is where everything makes difference. I mean, massively. What you do in the first few minutes after an injury determines very much what the outcome's going to be. And the example of that is impact brain apnea. That impact brain, often people don't have a significant brain injury. They die of a hypoxic brain injury because no one was there looking after their airway or even just loss of airway from a motorcycle accident. They often don't have a brain injury. They haven't got lots of blood in their head. So if you can get in there quickly and manage patients and then manage them well in that transfer period, I think that stands people for such a much better optimization for the subsequent outcome than anything else. So I think the pre-hospital arena is utterly, utterly key to keeping people who have had a brain injury the same person they were before.
Listen, that's fantastic, Mark. And I really appreciate your time tonight. We'll put in the show notes some of the resources you mentioned from the Good Sam app to some of the seminal papers and the empirical literature that we mentioned. I'll put that in the show notes. But thank you, Mark, for your time.
Well, thank you. Take care. Thanks, Sam.
That was brilliant, Mark. That was fantastic. Look, that was absolutely fantastic. That was cool. Great.
Right. Oh, hopefully it's useful. I don't need to hear it. I'm happy with all that.
You sure? Thanks.
Yeah,
mate.
Yeah. Just put it all out there. It's fine.
Yeah. Listen, perfect. 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 Listen, you're a legend. Legend. Cool. I'll let you enjoy your evening because it's quite late. And I really, really hope your eyes sort of.
Yeah, I'm going to go to bed and see if I can get it better by going to bed.
Yeah, no, Mark, okay. Do that. Absolutely. Have you got a few days off? Or
No. Nor tomorrow.
Okay. Okay. Listen, yeah. Well, let's sort out coming to Farnborough and having a chat with us.
Yeah, it'll be good.
Phillips, and we'll see what we can collaborate on in the future.
Brilliant.
All right. Legend, Mark. Listen, you're a star. Cheers, buddy.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.